One annual event we track very closely every year is the RSS Chief or Sir Sangh Chalak's Dashera Day address. Now that has always been significant. Usually it was seen as a ritual. A few things were said, it made a little news. Now it is tracked very closely because now it has become a preeminent political statement of the year. Now I won't say that this is like another State of the Union address, but this isn't that far from it, because the Prime Minister speaks on Independence Day, the President speaks, delivered speeches that are given to her by the Cabinet. But most importantly, this is an ideological government in Delhi. This government draws its ideology and its basic understanding of politics, society, economics, and life from its spiritual and ideological guru, which is the RSS. So the RSS chief now has a different stature. The stature is not, it's not a formal stature, but it is the stature that the constitution does not provide for. But it's the stature in real life, in real politics today, of being the guru of the ruling party. And the ruling party has a majority. That's why anything that Sir Sangh Chalak says makes news, particularly his speech on Dashera Day, which is like his annual statement of intent, ideas, policies. He also floats some trial balloons to see what the response is. And he's done exactly that today. Now, this Dashera speech has come on top of an unusual 3 or 4 days when India's woke community, or India's what used to be called left liberal or liberal community, liberal has got very mixed up now. So let me just go with the modern usage, which is woke community. They've been very excited by something that a very senior member, almost in terms of stature and power, like being the number two to the RSS chief, that is Sarkareva Dattatre Hosabale. Now, my Kannadiga friends, particularly our managing editor, YP Rajesh, she cautions me that I have my North Indian pronunciation of his name, which is not right. It's not Hosabale. It should be something like Hosabare. So I don't know if I make it worse by trying to pronounce it that way. But you can see the spelling and pronounce it right. I will keep working on my pronunciations. So Dattatre Hosabale, he delivered this speech just a couple of days back, where he said some very strong things about the state of India's economy, joblessness, the number of poor having risen in our economy, poverty rising. And it was seen by Modi critics immediately as an RSS censure of Narendra Modi. Now, those of us who've seen the RSS and BJP closely, we know that such things don't happen, particularly when a Modi is in power in Delhi. So we have been of the view, I have been of the view, that the Modi government and this RSS are fully on the same page. They work together. They are like caught so-and-so, bowled so-and-so, right? So one bowls, the other catches. It's like that. They are on the same team. There is no difference. It was different, say, in the times of Atal Bihari Vajpayee, because he was seen often enough by the RSS as straying from the basic ideological beliefs or ideological training. Because Atal Bihari Vajpayee was seen as more liberal, more outgoing, more unhyphenated to his RSS training. He respected RSS leaders and the leadership then. It was K.S. Sudarshan then, eventually succeeded by Mohan Bhagwat, who was always at odds with Vajpayee and said rude things about him. This is not the situation right now. So it's not as if a difference of opinion has broken out between the RSS and the BJP, and it's not as if through Dattatre Hosabale's statement, RSS was censuring Narendra Modi. He was essentially saying what the RSS has been saying, because RSS's view of the economy, RSS's view of wealth creation is in some ways very different. It's very conservative, it's very puritanical. They believe in a particularly austere, non-materialistic way of life. So all those issues are there, and that is what he was saying. If any doubt still remained, those were set aside today in the Sir Sangh Chalak speech. Because what has he said? First of all, on the economy. On the economy, he said that, look, you must understand that government can't create jobs for so many people. We are a lot of people. In no country does the government produce more than 15% of the jobs. The rest of the jobs have to come from private sector. All have to come from, and this is where the RSS ideology comes in, most of it has to come from micro and small industry, and from self-employment, which is Swarozgar. Now, that is the RSS view of life and way of life. May or may not be that practical, but that's what they believe in. So, effectively, it's a defense of the Modi government that if there is joblessness, don't blame the government. Try and create jobs for yourselves. Also, on many other aspects of the economy that Mohan Bhagwat spoke today, you can see that he is in harmony with Modi government, or RSS is in harmony with Modi government. So, first point, toss any thought this RSS is now getting angry with Modi and will get rid of Modi and give you somebody else. No such thing is happening. RSS and Modi government, you can see, are together. And this speech is evidence. We found four important strands in this speech. The first I told you, the statement on the economy and joblessness, etc. Number two is the statement on the outreach to Muslims. So he has mentioned that lately you found that we have had our senior people, our responsible leaders have had conversations with Muslims. And then he's gone on to say, this is nothing new. This has been happening for a long time since we were founding. Our founders also wanted these conversations. And then he mentions one Dr. Jilani, who had come to meet Golwalkar, who RSS people address as Guruji. So he says the Guruji or Dr. Jilani ki meeting ke baad se khule mein baat aa gayi thi. We want to have these conversations. And he says, then he goes on to say that we have no enmity, we don't have any issue with how somebody pursues their religion, as long as everybody believes in the fact that we are part of the same nation, etc., 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 and nobody has to worry about the RSS's ideology. He said, we believe in Hindu Rashtra, but our view of Hindu Rashtra is there should be truth, there should be purity, there should be patriotism, etc., etc. He lists four attributes, and you can follow any faith as long as you believe in those attributes. You can be an equal Indian citizen. It doesn't matter. And these are his words. How you pray, where you pray, who you pray to, or who you pray to, how you eat, what you eat, how you sleep, in which direction do you have your feet, etc., etc. He said that doesn't matter to us. And then he goes on to elaborate to say that we are not just a land of the Hindus. We started out as a land of the Hindus because Hinduism was born there, but many other faiths grew here, and some of the faiths actually came in with invaders who stayed on and their faiths strayed on. So he stops there on these issues. He also says there is no need for anybody to fear the RSS. That's obviously a message to Muslims. He says the view of the RSS, the principle of the RSS is that we should be so strong that we should not have to fear anybody. At the same time, we will not scare anybody. He says that, and then he says everybody, even if they have grievances, and I think that's an indication to Hindus, if you have grievances, then act within the parameters of the law and constitution. Nobody should go beyond that. And then he mentions the horrific sacrilege killings in Udaipur and Amravati, and says it's a very good thing that many Muslim groups and prominent Muslims have also spoken out against that. Now, of course, if I could add just a second of opinion, I could add that once a group is in majority and a group is in power, its responsibility does not stop by making these statements of intent. All of this has to reflect in practice. So while this speech was given, we were watching pictures of these young people in Gujarat being flogged publicly, Taliban style, because they had supposedly or allegedly caused disturbance at a Garba festival. Now, if the law and constitution had to take their course, then nobody had the right to tie them in public and flog them in public with people watching. And that is why the whole world detests ISIS and the Talibanist culture. So a statement of intent is very good, particularly if the intent is good, as the Sarsang Chalak said in this case. But when these aberrations take place, then just as so many Muslims spoke out on the killings in Udaipur and Amravati, and the Sarsang Chalak is praising them for that, similarly, there should be more of an action and more of a revulsion at what's happened in Gujarat right now with these public floggings. That said, that was a tiny bit of opinion in the middle. I'll come back to the speech. Now, there are two more important things he says in this speech. First of all, there is language. language, he says, this time he does not talk of Hindi. He talks of mother tongue. And obviously, RSS has also understood that there's been a pushback from other languages, particularly Tamil in this case, that look, we are also Indian languages. You just can't be promoting Hindi all the time. And he says, look, why can't we have education in our own languages until at least class 10? And then he goes on to say that some of this has come in the new education policy, and textbooks are being done. And once this is done to school level, this will be done in higher education also. But he says that, remember, that most of the people, most of India's elites today, and most Indians who are now being admired and who are becoming famous all over the world, went to schools where basic education was given in their native languages. So it's not as if without English medium early on, you cannot build a career. Many things go into building a career. Then he says, I'm not saying that if you don't have education, basic education in your native language, you cannot become great nationalists, great leaders, great spiritualists, great whatever. And then he gives the example of Tilak, Gandhi, etc., who had not had basic education, early education in their native languages and yet became global leaders. That apart, he says it is better to at least till class 10 have education in your native language. But he is not saying Hindi, which is a very important thing. And in my view, a little bit of a shift as well. And then he says family value. And then the fourth one, and that's the most significant one. Fourth, he talks about population. And it's a very nuanced statement, and you can draw many meanings from it. And I think this is the one that requires the closest study. He says, first of all, he's moved away from the classical old Sarkari Indian position that smaller families are the ideal thing, that people should just not produce more children as much as possible because population is growing very fast and has become unmanageable. So he says population can be a good thing or a bad thing. It can be a liability. It can make a country unmanageable. At the same time, it can be an asset. And then he gives an example of China. He says, Chin to ab budha ho gaya hai. Now, when he said that, immediately I thought budha ho gaya is a bit much to say that China is an aged country. But if you check the data, China is a rapidly aging country. China's average age right now is about 39 years. India's is 28 years. You might see Pakistan's is about 23, 24 years. That means the more babies a country has been adding lately, the younger its population will be. That is a no-brainer. So China went for the one-child policy. And he elaborates on that. He said somebody, they went for a one-child policy. Then they found their population was aging. So they said, okay, two children. Now they say three children. But it's all a mess. So he's basically saying that it is not necessary to have an aggressive one-child policy or maybe a no-child policy, that you need a certain population. And a younger population is actually a good thing. So more babies would mean a younger population. But at the same time, he says that population imbalance can cause a problem. But that population imbalance is nothing but a ciphered statement or a coded statement for the belief that Muslim population is rising much faster than the Hindu population. Now, there are views there, and you can see that even the latest surveys, NFHS, etc., show that total fertility rate among Muslims is still higher than Hindus, but it's not as much higher as it used to be. And as the economics of Muslim families is changing, that gap is also narrowing, and is narrowing quite rapidly. But he goes on to say that this kind of imbalance can cause threats to national unity. And he gives three fascinating examples. He talks about Kosovo, South Sudan, and East Timor. So I read up on some of these. And in fact, you will see a story from one of my colleagues, a text story explaining what is he referring to in these countries and what exactly happened in these countries. But if you see Kosovo was a part of old Yugoslavia. Old Yugoslavia was not a voluntary union. It was supposedly a federal country, but Marshal Tito, using the power, the brute power of communist times, had got a lot of these Chota units together in a country called Yugoslavia. That Yugoslavia broke up. Yugoslavia broke up after the end of the Cold War. There were many wars after that. There was the Bosnian conflict. There was the Kosovo conflict, and there were many other conflicts which were religious, ethnic, linguistic, and that's where UN had got involved, and also multinational forces led by NATO had got involved, even on bombing missions. This was like a full-fledged war or a bunch of full-fledged wars. And then out of that warfare, seven new countries emerged. These seven new countries are Bosnia Herzegovina, Croatia, Kosovo, Montenegro, North Macedonia, Serbia, and Slovenia. So seven countries emerged out of one. So if you look at it from Marshal Tito's point of view, then it's a bit like is dil ke tukde hazar hue, koi yahan gira, koi wahan gira, except that ye unke dil ke tukde the. All of this might have been something that Joseph Broz Tito held close to his heart. But these countries, these ethnicities, these linguistic groups, they did not see themselves as members of the involuntary forcible union of Yugoslavia. That's how they broke up. And many of them are very small. So if you look at North Macedonia, just about 19 lakh people, never mind, even with that small a population, they beat Italy this time, prevented them from going to FIFA World Cups. So these are small countries with strong nationalism. And that's how Kosovo came into being. So Kosovo also has only about 18 lakh people. Now, why is this Sir Sangchalak referring to Kosovo? Because Kosovo was part of the larger Serbian zone. So unlike Serbia, which is today about 88% Christian, Kosovo, Serbia is a larger population. Kosovo is a much smaller population of less than 2 million, about 18 lakhs. Kosovo itself has 97% Muslim population. So the implication is that since a region on the periphery of Serbia or in old Yugoslavia bordering another Muslim majority country, that is Albania, had 97% Muslim population, it broke away. History is a bit complicated there. History has also involved many wars and many antagonists, so I'm not going there right now. That's not in our syllabus today. But the reason he's referring to this is because he thinks that the imbalance there, that in one country, Muslims were in much larger percentage in one section of it, that section broke away, and that is a problem because they broke away from the will of the larger majority in a much larger country. That's one. Second, South Sudan, similar story. So Sudan again has a very messy history, and again I can't go into that right now. It'll take me 10 minutes just talking about that, and maybe that'll be less. But since the 50s, when the process of decolonization took place, there's been dispute in Sudan. There have been many kinds of disputes. There have been a series of civil wars. But the biggest dispute in the end was between the northern part of Sudan, which is 97% Muslim, and the southern part of Sudan, where Muslims are only 18%. So in this case, now, I don't know what exactly does he mean. Does he mean that northern part, which has much higher population, that's about 3 crores, southern Sudan is about 80 lakhs, that they broke away and they could not carry the Christian majority region with them, and their population had caused an imbalance, Muslim population had caused an imbalance, or maybe he's referring to the south, but I don't think he's referring to the population of Christians having gone up that much in the south, although I can see from demographic numbers that even in the south, birth rate is quite high, and average age in South Sudan also is 18. But once again, he sees this as religious imbalance in population. So a larger but heavily Muslim majority region was not able to carry along with it smaller Christian dominated region. So once again, I think his prescription seems to be that you cannot have population imbalances, as he calls them, imbalances in different parts of a country, because that leads to trouble. And the third, he mentions East Timor, also called Timor-Leste. Timor-Leste is a very interesting case. Now, Timor-Leste was a part of Indonesia. It was earlier a Portuguese colony. It's an island close to Indonesia. Then Indonesian army went in, quite a bit like how Indian armed forces went into Goa and liberated it. So Goa became a part of India. It was a Portuguese colony until then. Similarly, Timor, East Timor was a Portuguese colony, and Indonesian army went and liberated it. But the East Timorese never accepted it, and insurgency started there. The difference is that while Indonesia is predominantly a Muslim country with a sizable Hindu minority and a very stable country East Timor was almost entirely a Christian place, entirely a Christian region. Even today, a small population, just over 1.5 million, in fact, 1.4 lakhs at last count, that many, but fully Christian, almost 98-99% Christian and Portuguese speaking. So in fact, East Timor in 1999, there was a UN mandated plebiscite in which people voted to be an independent country. So this country of a small population became independent and sovereign. It's a member of the UN and it broke away from Indonesia. So once again, the concern on Sir Sang Chalak's mind seems to be that, look, this is a country with a huge Muslim population, quite a large Hindu population relative to East Timor, even there, because people of a particular religion got together in one area, that is Christians in East Timor, they were able to break away. And that is what he sees as population imbalance. So he's not saying it, but as he's speaking, and if I can read his mind right, which I would risk doing, he's looking at Kashmir, he's looking at Assam, he's looking at West Bengal, he's looking at Western UP, he's looking at those regions of the country where I'd say the population of Muslims has gone above 30%, and his concern is that that may rise there faster than Hindu population, etc., etc. So don't have to agree with it. You can most certainly disagree with it. This is not the time for me to say whether I agree with it or not agree with it. This is cut the clutter. I try and keep opinion out of it as much as possible. For opinion, read the opinion section at the print and also read our 50-word edits. At Cut the Clutter, we give you the facts and simplify them as much as possible and leave it to you to arrive at a judgment. And when we speak opinion here, we qualify it, as I did just a while back when I brought in that flogging incident in Gujarat.